Vast, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, thou to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good afternoon. The beautiful weather we're having for the Shishin so far. Ernie, would you tell me if my voice is too soft for you back there, please? Take your name. No, seriously, if it needs to go up, just give me that sort of, and it's a little bit, give me that, a little bit gradation.
Do you want it up? That's better.
Yeah. Okay, this one. So, excuse me? We normally give some remarks in Angie's Sangha on sitting in the first day, just to get a little bit reoriented and focus in on the basics of why we're here. And sitting is the basis of our practice, Shikantaza, clear mind samadhi. We do it when we sit. We do it when we walk. We do it in the kitchen. Some people do it at work, doing dishes, whatever. But it's fairly basic. We do it sitting on a zavu, on a zabaton. Posture is the key to it. Posture and breathing. Kind of a dyad of sitting practice to focus or be aware in a body sense of our posture and our breathing, to be aware of our breath, the taste of it, the flow of it, the heat of it, as a kinesthetic experience, not a mental experience. We don't want to focus on our thinking at all. Let our mind loose. See what flows in our mind, what flows out, the eternal observer, without stopping it or encouraging it to stay, or, as they used to say, inviting it to tea. And balance is an important part of that posture. We sway to side to side. We sway back and forth, back and front, trying to find that still point, that center point, where we don't experience any bodily weight if we're doing it really well. But it isn't necessary to do it really well. And we're not trying to be perfect in any way. This is an as-is practice. But we want to find a centering place so we don't have much stress on our body when we sit. If we're sitting eccentrically a little bit, we'll be throwing stress on our body, we'll feel that. And that's eccentric back and forth. We can usually find that pretty easily when we sat for a while, but each time we sit, we have to do it all over again. Our bodies change. We change as we sit in zazen. Our breathing slightly changes our body position, microscopically. And in a sitting, you may be a little bit out of alignment. So it's a constant awareness of our posture and our breathing as the basic dyad of sitting. It's not complex. And with practice, it gets to be natural and normal. In the early days, Kogan would talk about a silver thread holding us up from the cosmos, that we are supported. not tightly, not loosely, but let's say tautly, almost like a puppet. So you have looseness in your body and no tension. And you have the support. So you're sort of free on the zafu, which is a good place to be. We keep our chin in for the most part, and we lengthen the part of our neck, the back of our neck. We put that in a slight extension. And that helps our posture too. It puts a lumbar curve in our lower back and keeps our stomach out a little bit. Our breathing is into our lungs deeply as we can. And we visualize breathing into our hara, the center of our being in the Asian cultures. We hold our hands in a cosmic mudra. It's an oval shape. And the fingers are touching, but not quite. And Kobun would lean forward and say, you could slide a piece of paper between those two thumbs. So it's really a beautiful example of our non-dual practice, not two and not one. Yes, they're touching, and yes, you can slide a piece of paper between them. So, it's an interesting gap that we have there in our thumbs. Might think of it as a mechanism to control or be aware of how we're doing. We feel the sensations of our thumbs as we breathe, as we sit. It's a kind of a grounding sensation. The cosmic mudra is indicative of sitting with all things, the cosmos, which is our practice. Nothing is excluded. The principle of non-separation, which is one of the bases of the practice, is we sit with everything that ever is and ever was. So the cosmic mudra is appropriate. One of the important things, I think, in one early sitting is not to put tension in the shoulders. I started out with shoulders like this. So I said, get those shoulders down. So it's easy to do, to let the shoulders slide up and induce that stress on our body, which is totally unnecessary. Over time, the body adjusts to the sitting, and the stress goes down. Kobun would tell us he didn't feel any stress whatsoever in a 7-day shishin. Didn't tell us why or how. But I think it's sitting concentrically. He found that point intuitively every time he sat, and there was no eccentric loading on his body, and he had no stress. I think that's all I want to say on that. Does anybody have any questions on that? Okay. Yes?
Could you offer some advice to chair sitters? It's a little different, I guess.
Yes, very good question. What I would suggest is experiment with a tripod. Two legs and a butt, 1/3 each weight. So sit forward on the chair and put a lot more weight on your legs and see how that goes. Because a tripod position is very old in our practice. Usually the tripod is two knees and the butt on the zafu. You want to get those knees down, but if you're sitting in a chair, you can't do that. But the object is to get the soles up. So the size of bench covers it, but sitting on a chair doesn't quite, but if you have to, you have to. But you can moderate that by moving forward and trying some weight on the legs so you get more into a tripod instead of one loading on the chair itself. I think it might change your body mentality and your kinesthesiology as you sit. But only you can tell. Trust your experience. Okay, if there's no other questions.
I have a question, sorry.
Ah, sorry, excuse me,
Did
Mary.
Did you talk about Kinhin, walking meditation?
I mentioned it at the start of the talk, but I'm happy to talk about Kinhin. It's a very important practice. It's not exercise. It's important. It's moving meditation, clear mind samadhi in motion. Kitchen, clear mind, samadhi, and motion with activity. But Kinhin is just walking with a clear mind. And it's a powerful practice, not to be thought of as exercise at all. You could do that a lot longer than 10 minutes. You could do that at home for a half hour or an hour. It's a beautiful way to take a walk. I walk in the Santa Cruz Mountains every day for about 40 minutes, and I use a rather faster Kinhin that I learned from my Dharma sister here, Paula, some years ago. And I guess she got it from Thich Nhat Hanh. So there are ways to walk but with various speeds and maintain our awareness. Just takes some practice. But it's a wonderful practice. Did I answer your question?
Well, I guess I've heard in the Zendo that you take a step on every out-breath, but when you're outside, if you're, you know, kind of paying attention to nature, then you're not paying attention to the breath. Is that right?
No.
Okay. So you're paying attention to all of it.
No, you're focusing down on your path. And I use a faster step. I do either four steps a breath, mm-hmm. two on the inhale and two on the out, or I do two. One on the inhale, one on the out. Sometimes they do five on the inhale and five on the out. Well, it depends on how you feel. But the eyes are down at 45 degrees. So you're not getting yourself distracted so much. But it's a little bit more challenging than being in the Zendo. But it's good practice for being at work. Being in activities, to practice a clear mind like a mirror. What's out there, you see, and you reflect back, no thinking. Any other questions? Okay, we're going to be discussing the mountains and rivers or mountains and waters sutra. Dogen Zenji's really masterwork in the Shobogenzo.
GPS signal lost.
And I'd like to start out a little bit with discussion of how that came to be written, and how it was written, the language, because I think it's very important for the understanding of it, because it's so complex and rich. And the way I'd like to work with it today is I have it here on the San Francisco Zen Center's Kaz Tanahashi and the people at Zen Center and several other noted priest practitioners had a hand in this, which is very important because it's so complex, which I'll get into, that it's very useful to have more than one eye look at this. And they did, and it's a very smooth and wonderful translation, I think, compared to my one, my 1977 one from John Stevens and Nishiyama was also very good. This is a little bit better, I think, and I highly recommend it, especially on the digital version, because you can carry this around very easily, and this is very, very handy to dip into it. Because Dogen is holographic. You can jump in there almost anywhere, and you're right where you need to be. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity. But what I'd like to do is pass this around to read a few paragraphs, and then I'll have it on my iPhone here, and I can follow along, and we can talk about it. I can talk about it and have some comments, and then we'll go to the next few paragraphs. Because this is so rich that the talk about this wouldn't be appropriate. I think we should take it up directly. But to get back to Dogen and writing it, it was written in 1240 in Japanese, medieval Japanese. This is highly unusual and really important because no scholar, intellectual, priest, wrote in Japanese in Japan in that time period. They all wrote in Chinese. So here's this medieval Japanese, and as I understand it, the present-day Japanese cannot understand that very well. And there's maybe up to 24 translations of the Shobo Genzo in modern Japanese. That's how complex it is. So here we have it in modern Japanese, and we translated it to English. So how far we are from Dogen's original work, we don't know. It's also good to keep in mind that our practice is beyond words and concepts. So we're out on a slim branch here. There are two great ancestors that we have that focus on what they call words and lips. The first is Chow Chow, the famous master who started teaching at 80 and he taught till 122. But he was famous for turning phrases. He developed the famous koan, the case of does the dog have Buddha nature? Chakra says no. And threw a monk into a bit of a tizzy. So Chakra's one and Dogen is the other one. So they do have that in common. And so with that preamble, I think it's good if we can start. I could ask for a volunteer so we could start here or over there and read a few paragraphs. How would we like to do that? Okay.
Yeah. Clear voiced on this.
Yeah.
Just read this.
What I have it, just 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Mountains and Rift Waters Sutra. Mountains and waters right now actualize the ancient Buddha expression. Each, abiding in its condition, unfolds its full potential. Because mountains and waters have been active since before the empty eon, they are alive at this moment. Because they have been the self since before form arose, they are emancipation actualized. Because mountains are high and broad, their way of riding the clouds always extends from the mountains. Their wondrous power of soaring in the wind comes freely from the mountains.
This is hold it there. I think we've got enough to talk about there. Mountains and waters. Firstly, Dogen is calling out iconic elements in ordinary life. Mountains. Who doesn't know mountains? In the world, how many people haven't heard of the Himalayas, the Andes, the Alps, the Rockies? They're monumental, and the same with the waters, the oceans, the rivers, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Mississippi, the Rhine, the Amazon. So he's calling attention to the iconic landmarks in human history to get our attention. That this is, he's really going to lay it on the line here. And the sutra, this is the only one of his fascicles that he calls the sutra, so it gives us some importance there too. Is the sutra from Dogen, or is the sutra from the mountains and waters? When you read this, it feels like it's from the mountains and waters giving this teaching. There's a lot of imagery in there about that, the animation and non-animation of the mountains and the oceans and rivers. So, mountains and waters right now actualize the ancient Buddha expression. That is a very, very powerful statement. Actualize the ancient Buddha expression. The ancient Buddhas are expressing, actualizing in this present, precious, eternal moment. Powerful, powerful. Each abiding in its condition. Condition is case one that we discussed a couple of months ago in Floating Zendo. Dharma King's Dharma is as is. Its condition is as is. Unfolding its full potential as is. Mountain as is. Bird as is. Rivers as is. Humans as is. Because mountains and waters have been active since before the empty eon, empty kalpa, they are alive at this moment. And we think of mountains as being composed of granites and igneous rocks and whatever. And they're inert. In the Buddha Dharma, that's not the case. There aren't distinguishments like that. This differentiation of animate and inanimate. And anything else, you know, that's a distinguishment, male and female and in directions and all those dyads that we have in our ordinary life don't function in the Buddha Dharma. He says the mountains are alive. He doesn't say they're not alive. He says they're alive. Later he says they're not alive. He says not animate. Here he says they are alive, which is true. Because they have been the self, the true self, since before form arose, before the empty eon, the empty kalpa. So these are not bound by emptiness. The Dharma exists in emptiness. Our life exists in emptiness. Emptiness doesn't mean nihilism. It's reality. We live in reality. The Dharma is in reality. And the self is reality too. Their emancipation actualized. The mountains are emancipation actualized. The Dharmakaya actualized. Existing. Because mountains are high and broad, their way of riding the clouds always extends from the mountains. Riding the clouds, non-separation. Principle of our practice, our teaching, non-separation. We sit with everything that exists, everything that did exist. And here he is saying, riding the clouds exist. Clouds and mountains are one. Clouds flow, mountains flow, rivers flow. Caterpillar walks across the table, mountain walks across the table. Any comments on that? One thing I didn't mention, this is so dense and rich and complex and difficult that it's good to not fixate on ideas here. Keep a fluid mind with this. It's deep and it's in words which have been translated and retranslated. So it takes some fluidity here not to get attached to some of these concepts. Keeping in mind that our practice is beyond words and concepts. Would you like to read the second paragraph?
Sure, it's only one line. Priest.
What a line, though.
Dayokai of Mount Urong said to the assembly, "The green mountains are always walking. A stone woman gives birth to a child at night."
This is in a case form, koan form. Green mountains are always walking. The Buddha Dharma is alive and well. It flows. A stone woman is us. Gives birth to a child at night. The night is the Dharma. The light and love of the Dharma exist in the darkness. The sutra is very clear. No eyes, no ears, no nose. No eyes. Eyes don't see, it's dark. The stone woman gives birth. Well, stone women don't give birth, right? They're stone, they're barren, they don't give birth. That's us. We learn about the Buddha Dharma and we take it with a grain of salt, perhaps. Maybe not, maybe this, maybe that. But we don't act on it until we do and a birth is given. A birth into the Buddha Dharma at night to a child. Kencho. So I ask you, is that birth to a parent or a child? That should be clarified. Can you read the third one, please?
Mountains do not lack the characteristics of mountains. Therefore, they always abide in ease and always walk. Examine in detail the characteristic of the mountains walking.
Mountains do not lack the characteristics of mountain. Mountains are the Dharma King's Dharma as is. Therefore, they always abide in ease. They are as is. And always walk. They're connected to everything else. When Bodhidharma was going back to India, he called his three disciples together. And he said, "I'm going to transmit one of you. I want you to manifest the Dharma for me. And the first one said something, and Bodhidharma, I think, said, you have my blood or something. And then the second one said something, and he said, you have my bones. And Huike is air, said nothing. He did a deep breath show, and Bodhidharma said, you have my marrow. Show. Immensely powerful. The universe responded. And Bodhidharma transmitted to Huike. So we see that here. They always abide in ease. They're themselves as is. And always walk. Examine in detail the characteristics of the mountains walking. That's examined in our practice. Perfecting the Dharma eye in Zazen. Any comments? Would you read the next one, please?
Mountains walking is just like human walking. Accordingly, do not doubt mountains walking, even though it does not look the same as human walking. The Buddha ancestors' words point to walking. This is fundamental understanding. Penetrate these words.
We penetrate the words with practice. Shikantaza, practice, sitting and walking. Mountain walking does not look the same as human walking. Mountain walking is as is. Human walking is as is. We manifest our basic Dharma nature as human beings, and the mountains manifest theirs as mountains. Can you read the next one, please?
Because green mountains walk, they are permanent. Although they walk more swiftly than the wind, sometimes in the mountains, someone in the mountains does not notice or understand it. In the mountains means the blossoming of the entire world. People outside the mountains do not notice or understand the mountains walking. Those without eyes to see mountains cannot notice, understand, see, or hear this reality.
This is a similar statement, similar event in our practice line of Shakyamuni. Raising the Adambara flower, and Mahakashpaya, the first ancestor, came forward. The flower was the blossoming of the entire world, no separation. 2,000 monks are out there watching that. Only Mahakashpaya grasped that. With a smile, he stood up and walked to the front of the assembly and sat down next to Shakyamuni, facing out. You get back to that stone woman again. 2,000 monks. Would somebody else like to read? Thank you very much for the reading. If you'd like to continue, it's fine, but I thought maybe somebody else would like to read.
I'm tired of my voice. Anybody else want to read? Okay. If you doubt mountains walking,
all right,
you do not know your own walking. It is not that you do not walk, but that you do not know or understand your own walking. Since you do know your own walking, you should fully know the green mountains walking.
Knowing is dharma, experience. Difficult to talk about that. Yeah, our walking is a mountain walking. If you doubt mountains walking, you doubt you're walking with a clear dharma eye. That's true. And he says, since you do know your own walking, you should fully know the green mountains walking. That you know, in the sense, in deep practice, with the zazen eye, the mountains walk if you walk. Can you read the next one, please?
Green mountains are neither sentient nor insentient. You are neither sentient nor insentient. At this moment, you cannot doubt the green mountains walking.
He mentioned that above, too, in different verbiage. The green mountains are neither sentient nor insentient. Below, he talks about the green mountains are neither animate or inanimate. This is not two, not one. The non-duality of our practice, the non-duality of the Dharma. Very difficult to put a finger on the Dharma. This is don't know mind, the highest mind in our practice. Things we know, we put a label on. That's the ordinary world labeling. Mathematicians have all this mathematics from boundary conditions and whatnot. Those are concepts. And our practice is beyond those. So he says, neither sentient nor insentient. Master Dogen is using it's a practice term, it's escaping me right now. Can't think of it. But he's using skillful means, yes, he's using skillful means here to point the way to the non-duality there. Neither sentient nor insentient. Neither relative nor absolute. At this moment, you cannot doubt the green mountains walking. They're animate. They're connected to everything that ever was and ever will be. They flow. Even in this ordinary world, they flow. These mountains here, the Santa Cruz Mountains, are slowly slipping towards Los Angeles in some X million years or whatever. They'll be down close to it. The Himalayas rise, I believe, a quarter to a half an inch per year. So we have a view of life as being very fixed, but it's very impermanent. And the mountains, of course, along the Pacific Rim, the so-called Rim of Fire, with these tectonic plates, they juggle around and move around a lot, sometimes with horrific consequences. earthquakes, death tolls, and tsunamis. So things are a lot more fluid than we give credit for. Read the next one, please.
You may not notice that you study the Green Mountains using numerous worlds of phenomena as your standards. Clearly examine the Green Mountains walking and your own walking. Examine walking backward and backward walking. And investigate the fact that walking forward and backward has never stopped since the very moment before form arose, since the time of the King of the Empty Aeon.
King of the Empty Aeon, I'm taking as the Dharma King of Emptiness. Walking forward and backward, stepping backward is stepping into the Dharma Eye, Zazen. Walking forward, metaphor for stepping out into the ordinary world. We have our choice. Not many take the step back. And delusion and the rest of it just continues, deepens. Any comments on any of this? Yes.
I haven't heard the empty aeon before. What is the empty aeon?
Well, I think he's referring to kalpas, those very long time frames, millions of years, that they have in Buddhist cosmology and Chinese cosmology. We have to understand that Master Dogen is pretty versed in Chinese culture. He spoke Chinese, he can write Chinese. He was communicating with Ru Jing, his master in China, very nicely. So he picked up a lot of folk tales and stories and whatnot. I think he's using some of those in his writing. But as I say, I believe it's just before time began, before matter existed, he's saying the Dharma existed, which is a sort of a contradiction in terms, which I say, you got to keep an open mind on this because we have all these translations.
Describing timelessness, though, that everything simultaneous, you're stepping back, you're stepping forward, that there is that aspect of fully being alive to timelessness and one with everything that allows us to experience the aliveness of the ever-present eons forward and backward in this moment.
Yes, yes. That's implied in that first sentence. That the only time that exists is right now, in this eternal, precious moment. And it's not flowing, it's just happening. And we've invented this time past and time forward. For our human purposes, we sell our time for work or whatever the devil is. But it's not true. And I see your point there. Yeah, the stepping back. Wherever you step, you're stepping into the present, precious moment. Whether you come backward or forward, you're still there. If you're backward, you step back into Zazen, you have the opportunity to realize that time, as Zazen, time, as scintillating diamond. If you're walking forward into the daily life, are you submerged in, you know, minutia, duties, tasks, arguments? That's the way I would look at that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting stance, and I think you're correct. It's time dependent. Everything here is time dependent. He wrote this within a month of writing Uji, Being Time. He was very prolific at this period. He was 40 years old. And he wasn't at Heiji, he was in Kyoto. And I think he founded Heiji a few years later. So he wasn't in the mountains when he wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
But he always had a lifelong love of the mountains. And he had a hermitage in the mountain for many years in which he did his writing. But the time is so important. The time is the essence of it.
The next one?
Please.
If walking had stopped, Buddha ancestors would not have appeared. If walking ends, the Buddha Dharma cannot reach the present. Walking forward does not cease. Walking backward does not cease. Walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. This is called the mountain's flow and the flowing mountains.
I would take that as whether we are aware of the Dharma or not, the Dharma exists. You walk forward in your daily life, you're still in the Dharma. That's the reality of our existence, whether we agree with it or not. So, walking forward does not cease. People do that. They walk forward, they do their daily activities. They don't know about any other life or practice. Walking backward does not cease. There are always people. 2,500 years this line has been going. And there's been 6 or 7 other Buddhas that preceded Shakyamuni. So it's been happening a long time. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. This is called mountains flow on the flowing mountains. So walking backwards, being in Zazen, opening the Zazen eye, doesn't impede daily life. And walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. Walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. So activity doesn't impact our state, our beingness. The difference is that, the difference is, Shakyamuni Buddha was asked one time by a villager, what do you monks do all day? And the Buddha said, we sit, we walk, and we eat. And the villager says, well, we do the same thing. What makes you so different? And he said, well, when we sit, we know we're sitting. And when we walk, we know we're walking. And when we eat, we know we're eating. So you have walking forward and walking backward. And there's a conversation between the two. No conflict. Might have got a Sangha member. Please.
May I just check, do a time check?
Yes, please.
For us?
Yes.
So we are past the time where we would have stopped and started Kinyin.
Okay.
It's 4:30. So
alrighty, we should stop then. numberless, I vow to say them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to tend them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to spin them. Buddhist sayings are sunrise, I vow to become it.